Life's a Beach by Chai Chak, read by Cookie Mom 6067. According to the Federation Encyclopedia, Ryza is a Federation member planet that designates itself as a pleasure planet, its main industries being tourism, fishing, and assisted fertility treatments. Photographs from orbit show a marble-like planet positioned like a jewel on a black velvet tray, fit for a betrothal, perfectly blue and green, with swirls of white as sand you can see from orbit. Spock is an hour out from Starbase 4, on his way to meet up with Jim for their promised dirty weekend, and he is very keen to prepare as best as he can for this, without needing to read anything salacious nor ask anyone any uncomfortable questions. He is, after all, still on duty. The shuttle is quiet, save for Erica, who offered to pilot him to the starbase to, quote, get out of the house, and who will be flying the shuttle back, all in exchange for a list of semi-contraband alcohol that Spock has promised to try and acquire. Ooh, Ryza, she says, rubbernecking at his pad screen as they cruise along at a comfortable warp 2. Have you been before?
I have not, Spock says. It will be my first time vacationing on a beach. I usually return to Vulcan to visit my mother.
You'll love it, Erica says. It was very cool before the war. Not quite trendy, but still a bit of a hidden gem, if you know what I mean. But the war almost destroyed the tourism industry, so it's been struggling ever since. I wish I was going. Which resort?
Lalonga Bay, Spock says, and Erica whistles through her teeth.
Damn, your man loves you, she says, but does not elaborate further. How are you getting back?
Jim and I will be picked up by the Farragut in 3 days' time, and then I will rejoin the Enterprise a week later at Starbase 13. I will be advising on the development of their sciences strategy for the new year, and also viewing their new raw materials laboratory alongside other responsibilities.
Dirty weekend into a business trip, the life of a modern officer, Erica says. And the computer pings that they're approaching the warp limit for the system.
Yeah, I know, she says to the computer, and drops them out of warp with a flourish.
They enter the stack of other shuttlecraft waiting for a landing spot at the starbase and spend the next 15 minutes in companionable silence.
Hey, Spock, Erica says, as they inch their way closer to landing. She sounds nervous.
So, I have a friend on Starbase 1. She knows Jim Kirk quite well, and look, I want to know that you know about him, right? About his reputation?
Spock does not let his confusion affect his face, however much he wishes to. I do not think it is appropriate for us to gossip about my significant other while on duty.
Spock, come on, shuttlecrafts don't count. We both know that.
Lieutenant Ortegas, Spock says firmly, hoping to shut this down because she isn't wrong necessarily. Regulations say that those in the front seats designated pilot flying and pilot monitoring are not allowed to perform any other work responsibilities while in command of a shuttlecraft. Gossip is basically all you are allowed to do.
He takes a deep breath.
Lieutenant Kirk and I have discussed our relevant pasts. I appreciate your concern for me and value our friendship. However, you do not need to worry.
Erica purses her lips but nods.
All righty, I can't say I did not try.
The ensuing silence is decidedly more awkward, but thankfully they get their landing slot, and 20 minutes later he and Erica part ways with nothing more than a collegial nod. Jim is waiting for him at the shuttle port, his standard-issued duffel bag slung over one shoulder, looking as handsome as ever. They greet each other with a gentle kiss, and it is thrilling, after everything, to have this, for no one to care about them. There is a scheduled shuttle service between Starbase 4 and Ryza that leaves on the hour, and these things tend to be slick if you let them be. And so they go with the flow, making small talk about the latest fleet gossip with the middle-aged civilian couple across from them, and within a short hop, they're there. The climate of Ryza is perfect, by design, as Spock had read in the encyclopedia, but he had been worried that perfect would be only for the Federation average rather than for persnickety half-Vulcans. But on landing, Spock takes a moment to appreciate just how lovely Ryza is. The base temperature is a balmy 37 degrees, but the ever-present breeze brings that down by an average of 5 to 7 degrees depending on the time of day. The water is perfect and advertised as being blood warm, crystal clear, and delicately blue. The people are friendly and professional, wearing very little. The woman who welcomes them at the shuttle port is in barely more than a halter neck one-piece swimsuit with a white skirt of long white tassels and very little else. But she has the clear-eyed edge of someone who considers hard work to be a virtue. She hands them their key cards and the resort wristbands and then directs them to their room. "Relax, boys," she says, friendly but calculating. "You're on Ryza. Get out of those uniforms and have a good time." The hotel is in the Quillari style, rows of broad sweeping low ripples of suites built into the dunes, looking out over the perfect white sand beach, hidden away behind huge fronds of seagrasses. Their suite is on the top floor, which is barely 15 meters off the ground, but provides somewhat a semblance of privacy. Which might be why, as soon as they venture onto the balcony, Jim pushes him gently down onto the lounger, strokes open his uniform pants, and sucks him down to the root. Jim obviously takes great pride in this, has described himself as a high achiever, and Spock cannot help himself from petting his face, feeling the stretch of his mouth and the subtle movement of his tongue root against the sensitive muscle of his dick, before remembering and instead fisting his hands in Jim's chestnut brown hair and going along for the ride. He comes embarrassingly quickly. Had Jim not been putting his whole being into it, and empties himself down Jim's throat with a grunt and tight hands on the back of his head. Jim pulls off and looks thoroughly pleased with himself, and it's all too sexy for Spock to do much more than bask in the light of him, as pleasure crackles through his hands and feet, like he's been hit by a phaser set to come. In the sunlight, Jim stands up, strips his uniform off, before lying down next to Spock, naked and aroused, but seemingly unhurried. They kiss, and Jim's eyes sparkle with mischief. "You want to try something?" Jim says, drawing a finger down Spock's side sexily. "Yes," Spock breathes, and Jim gets him to roll over onto his front, and Spock struggles out of his clothes. And then, as soon as he's naked, Jim climbs on top of him, kissing the top knob of his spine before kissing down, sucking a bruise on top of every bone. "Jim," Spock gasps, as Jim kisses him right on his. "Just relax," Jim says, resting his chin on Spock's hip and tracing fingertips over his left hand, broadcasting erotic anticipation. "I promised you a dirty weekend. Let me inaugurate it properly." And so Spock does, rests his face in the privacy of his own arms and gasps, overstimulated and also bizarrely underestimated as Jim thoroughly tongue-fucks his ass, screwing him open with his wriggling muscle that Spock had never truly considered could be that strong and deliberate. Spock feels his own thick, hard dick resting against his leg again and gasps to himself, so sensitive he's unsure how he's even going to come, but utterly desperate to, and makes noises to indicate as such. Behind him, he hears a click of a bottle opening, and Jim has his fingers back inside him alongside that tongue, but Spock can tell he's loose and ready, and so looks over his shoulder at Jim, raising an eyebrow. "How do you want me?" Jim says, as he slicks his big fat red dick up idly with one hand. Spock drops back down onto his front, pulling his knees underneath him, and hears Jim groan in response. "What a fucking peach," Jim says appreciatively. "I'll just slide right in then." And he does, puts his hands in Spock's hair as he does to hold him still while he gets settled, finds the right angle, and then wastes no time in ruthlessly pressing his advantage, setting a hard yet slow and steady pace,
putting a twist into the roll of his hips over and over again until Spock is insensate and pleading in a voice he barely recognizes, and Jim is spread across his back, whispering filthy words of encouragement into his ear, all the while sucking the tip between his teeth because he knows Spock's body better than any being in existence, and so knows how much it turns them both on. Spock comes for the second time, untouched, down his own thighs, his ass fully driving the show. And he knows his shields are down because he can feel at least two telepaths on the edge of his senses, one of whom is bemused at him for making such a racket, and the other utterly furious, and he cannot care even a tiny jot about either of them. Jim has been talking the whole time, and Spock tunes back in to hear the end, his groan of, "Take it, take it. I fucking love your ass. I'm gonna fill you up," right before he pumps into him for the final time and chokes out a "gah" with a single final hard thrust that feels like it's dislodged something from his very soul. They both collapse on the daybed, Jim basking like a cat, and Spock rolling over to press against his side, reveling in the skin-to-skin contact. Jim runs his hands over Spock's chest and smiles. "Oh, I like this. What a surprise. I had removed my hair for someone," Spock said, "but I decided recently to stop. I find I prefer it this way." Jim digs his fingers into the short black hair curling against Spock's very prominent pectorals. "It's glorious. Whoever didn't like it has no taste." It is a very human thing. Vulcans are not hairy. "It suits you," Jim grins, squinting at him appraisingly. "Can you grow a beard?" "I can. I grew one after the war. The response to it was mixed." "Maybe we should have a stubble growing competition this weekend," Jim says, rubbing his own chin. "I mean, you'll win, but I think it'll be something I'll enjoy losing." "I agree." Jim laughs. "I haven't even mentioned the stakes." "I agree either way," Spock says, kissing him and rubbing their faces together. "Is there a defined itinerary for this dirty weekend?"
"Less of an itinerary and more of a checklist," Jim says breathily, as Spock kisses along his jaw and down his neck. "It's about developing maximal hedonism, sexual response, eroticism, touch, nakedness, intimacy, gentle exploration of sexual boundaries."
"That sounds acceptable," Spock replies between kisses, "though something we could have done in the privacy of either of our quarters." "There aren't massages on the ship," Jim points out, spreading his legs for Spock to slide down his body. "There isn't a huge lagoon with a swim-up restaurant full of fresh, oh God, seafood. There isn't sand or fresh air or huge soft beds, oh God. Though I'm speaking of the Farragut there, I don't know who Pike blew to get the Enterprise kitted out so extravagantly, but—" Spock pulls off. "Please do not impugn the captain's reputation so," he says, before sucking Jim back down and demonstrating exactly how he would get his own deck. "As I was saying before I was so gloriously interrupted," Jim sighs, once Spock retakes his place alongside him. "I think if we put clothes on, we lose points. But this is our first dirty weekend, so we aren't going for a perfect score, at least not this time. Let's go explore, get some food, see what this paradise is all about." Jim gets dressed while Spock is showering. He's always considered himself a snappy dresser, for a military man at least, tending towards the classics. And although they haven't seen each other in civvies all that much, he wants to look good. Spock steps out of the bathroom and Jim feels his eyes bug out of his head. He's wearing a pair of white trousers that tie loose on his hips, showing off his wide, impeccably chiseled chest and his newly rediscovered pelt of chest hair. He's wearing a loose jacket with large sleeves, a navy blue embroidered with white abstract patterns of flowers and leaves. There is structure to the jacket, like it is designed to be worn closed, but when worn so insouciantly, wide open, it looks positively indecent. Jim's crisp white shirt and navy shorts feel extremely pedestrian by comparison. He wants to tell Spock he looks incredible,
but he doesn't want to run the risk of Spock changing out of this absolutely gorgeous ensemble, so Jim just smiles broadly and snaps on a pair of sunglasses. Spock does the same, and they leave the room together out into the resort. Ryza is still up and coming as a destination, having only really been a member of the Federation for a couple of years before the war ruined everything. But in Jim's opinion, it's definitely going to end up the jewel in the crown. They are staying at a resort that blends effortlessly into the large town around a beautiful lagoon of crisp turquoise water. The people who walk around are all beautiful in the sunshine, men and women, and undetermined of every species Jim has ever seen and more besides. He takes Spock's hand in his, looking over at his face. His eyes are out of view beneath his glasses, but his mouth is holding a tiny amount of amused tension. They don't have a bond anymore, but Jim feels a little bit of bemusement crackle across his skin that he doesn't think is all him. They walk down the main promenade, down by the seafront, the picturesque white sands. They stop and get a drink from a man who is pulverizing fruits in what looks like an old-fashioned mangle beneath a sign that reads, "It's not a dream. Yes, you are on Ryza." The promenade is shaded by enormous trees that fan softly in the breeze, and they take a seat beneath one. A woman walks up to them, offering a wooden totem, and Jim waves her away politely. She looks disappointed, and maybe he's just being hasty, having been to other resort planets. The drink is delightful. The plant looks like bamboo, maybe a bit like sugarcane, but a deep, dark purple, and the drink is thick but sweet and tart, like mango juice crossed with a beetroot. "This would be great with rum," Jim observes, and Spock nods. They drink in silence, gazing out at the ocean. There are groups perched on some kind of launching system, watching as one by one they are flung into the air with some sort of catapult. "Looks fun," Jim says, and Spock sips his drink while eyeing it. "Dangerous." "Oh, definitely. Want to do it?" "Perhaps tomorrow," Spock says. "You mentioned massages." Jim cracks a wide smile. "You got it." They walk down the beach until they reach a set of massage tables laid out under the shade of some trees, and the woman at the booth scans their wristbands and gestures for them to undress. They strip down to their swimmers and lie down on the beds, the crashing waves and distant music from the nearby bar providing the soundtrack. Jim's masseuse is a tiny, elderly Ryzen woman, and Spock's is a man the size of a mountain, and Jim is a bit disappointed until Faya starts attacking his shoulders. "You are stiff," she says, "but you won't be for long." It doesn't sound like a threat, but it is. She's got the single-minded masochism that he recognizes from McCoy, and every small noise of exquisite pain she draws out of him makes her press harder. He swears at one point she cackles in delight when his toes curl in pleasurable agony. An hour later, Jim is wide awake and considering recommending Faya to Starfleet Intelligence to begin her true career as an interrogator, or, failing that, to the Klingons as a torturer, but he feels the lightest he has since the war. Even his arms seem to be able to move further than they could an hour earlier. "Thank you," he says genuinely, and Faya rolls her eyes. "It's just a massage. Don't get mushy." Spock is asleep, and Jim leaves him there and wanders down to the water to wash the oil off. It is perfect in every way. By the time he feels clean and comes back, Spock is both awake and has got them another couple of drinks. "I had them put rum in them," Spock says, as Jim chokes on the fumes. "Oh, we are going to have fun," Jim says. They decide to have lunch at a Ryzen place, eating something like grilled cheese sandwiches with mango, but bright pink and vaguely fizzy. They make plans to spend the afternoon on the beach, but a quick trip back to the room to pick up sun protection turns into a long, lazy fuck in the long white-clad bed and another nap, and by the time they make it out again, the sun is entering golden hour, so they decide to go for a swim instead. They swim the full breadth of the lagoon, racing each other. Spock is strong, but Jim swam at the academy, and in this case, technique outperforms brute strength any day of the week. They flop onto the rocky end of the beach, exhausted, and watch the sun setting across the sea, a riot of perfect golds, pinks, reds, and purples, in companionable silence. They walk back along the promenade and stop at a restaurant that serves enormous gyro-like wraps and devour them like they haven't eaten for a week. The food is good, fish and a tender local animal cooked long and slow. Spock gets the vegetarian option, an eggplant-like thing that is a bright jewel green and crispy at the edges, but melting and soft in the middle, and they exchange polite bites of each other's food. A woman at the next table has a plate of something that looks nacho-like, and Jim asks for the same thing, and they share that alongside some of the more lethal cocktails on the menu. By the time they're finished, Jim is mildly buzzed and full of a second wind. "We should do something," he says. "Do you have your communicator? I left mine in the room." Spock pulls out his communicator and they look at the listings for the evening. "There's a club a few blocks away." Jim says, "Let's go." "It says it is, quote, a club," Spock says, hesitating. "Jim, I am not a dancer."
"Nonsense. The way those hips move, live a little," Jim says, taking his hand and pulling him after him.
The club is indeed transliterated as the club, but it is all the same thing in the end. They're far too early for dancing. There's actually some cabaret acts performing, and the drinks continue to be strong and plentiful, and so they decide to entertain themselves by making out in the corner.
"So the chocolate thing," Jim whispers, fingering the menu with intent. "Is it true it's an aphrodisiac for Vulcans?"
"I believe it is about as effective as champagne and oysters are to humans," Spock replies. But when the waiter comes round, he orders the chocolate bomb blaster. "The expectation contributes to a placebo effect," he explains. "It is, however, an intoxicant, closer to marijuana than alcohol in effect. But as you have well noticed, alcohol does have an impact on my physiology."
"I'm going to need something stronger than rum," Jim says, perusing the menu again.
Spock looks over his shoulder. "May I recommend the blood wine? In my experience, that drink takes few prisoners."
Jim eyes him carefully. "You're going to have to tell me that story later."
But instead orders a lurid green drink that claims to both include real Parisian absinthe, but also a tequila worm.
"To the placebo effect," he toasts, once their drinks arrive, and Spock clinks his sugary monstrosity in reply.
There are three performances on the bill that night. The first is Orion Cora, a mime artist, the program says is from a planet called Trill, who tells a full and quite ribald story with just the movement of her body. It's like a cross between a clown and a burlesque act, and the heaving bosoms of many of her characters definitely help in conveying the eroticism of someone running into a wall several times. The second is a singer of Rise and Torch songs. She has a pretty voice, and there are a group of young women gathered near the front who reach their hands out every time she wanders nearby. But after the musical reality, neither Jim nor Spock are into slow ballads full of emotional realism. There's a short break between the second and third act in order to enlarge the stage. The room suddenly fills with people until it is standing room only, but their table still has a clear view all the way to the stage. The performer comes out alongside a band and their instruments, which look like a cross-section of musical instruments from across the Federation. There's a human drum set, two Vulcan lutes, a Tellarite brass instrument Jim can never remember the name of, but that his cousin played growing up, and three human women in black who have the typical look of backup singers, and a Bolian man who is wearing a jacket that matches the outfit of the man who is directing everyone around.
"I know that guy from somewhere," Jim says, nudging Spock in the side.
The man on the stage is Vulcan, perhaps 15 years older than Spock. He's talking to his backing band, preparing for his set, and from Jim's angle, his profile is strong and handsome. His hair is cut into a hyper-fashionable style and dyed a cool silver gray, and he's generally a very handsome man who moves around the stage with grace and a thread of authority. Eventually, the performer turns forward to look towards the sound engineer and makes a sequence of hand gestures, and Jim clicks his fingers once. He sees the telltale sign of the ice blue triangle painted over one eye. "Oh, shit," Jim says. "I gotta call my brother. That's, oh, God, what was his name?"
"Sarissa,"
Spock says readily. "Sarissa, yes. He wasn't Sam's favorite. He preferred Kenevan. Wait, hang on."
"I am a few years older than you," Spock says swiftly. "They were inescapable."
"You were an LLAP fan," Jim states calmly, but the corners of his mouth are tilting upward.
"I appreciated their musical talents," Spock said primly. "My mother believed an interest in popular music would make me more likely to make friends among my peers."
"Did it work?" Jim asks, fascinated.
Spock sighs. "No."
"How many times did you see them live?"
Another sigh. 13.
"And how many posters did you have on your wall?" Jim wheedles.
"Sam had at least 6, one for each of the main members plus a group poster."
Spock gives him the side eye. "None."
Jim scoffs.
"Liar."
"Our house was decorated by some of the finest interior designers on Vulcan. It would not be logical to ruin it with cheap, unframed art."
Jim raises an eyebrow. "Your father's words?"
Spock nods.
"Yes. I did, however, have a discreet charm on my stylus case that broadcast my allegiance to those who were in the know."
"Did it work?"
"I did make 2 acquaintances in an older cohort. One, Sobek, you could call my childhood best friend."
Jim raises his eyebrows.
"Well, we are learning things about each other tonight, aren't we?" he says, taking Spock's hand and squeezing before leaning over for a kiss. Jim was never a fan of LLAP, not just because it was Sam's thing, but because by the time he was aware of them, they were extremely uncool. There was always something strange about them. Their music was ostensibly Vulcan, though true Vulcan music fans said it was hopelessly derivative, with its pounding beats and strange, scratchy vocals layered over an impossibly deep bass. Vulcan music is known for its strange atonality that eschews conventional musical conventions and drives a certain type of person absolutely wild. Jim never got it. Even the watered-down version LLAP presented to the Federation. His parents thought it was just noise and said so frequently, and it was a frequent topic of argument between Sam and their father in particular. The lyrics always translated into something akin to "logic is logical," "logic is beautiful," "you are like logic to me," but they sounded extremely beautiful if you didn't speak Vulcan, the way certain languages always do when you are young and do not have your own universal translator yet. The dancing was good, though. LLAP had always had excellent dancing, led by the man now on stage above them. Even if Jim doesn't, quote, get the music, he can get the appeal of a very hot, very fit man gyrating to a beat, with impeccable muscular control and not a lot of clothing. He wonders if Spock ever learned any of these routines as a teen. It would explain some of his moves in the bedroom. Sarissa's set is a good half an hour of intensive dance. At one point, he brings out a woman who he introduces as his choreographer, a tiny human woman who dances as his mirror, and the two of them are absolutely mesmerizing, and Jim's jaw hangs open as they effortlessly match each other. Liquid sex and perfect control. It ends with a rousing, body-popping routine to LLAP's most famous hit, and Jim absolutely blames the alcohol for how enthusiastically he sings along and how hard he claps and cheers when Sarissa takes his bows and wishes the audience peace and long life. After the show, Spock offers to go to the bar for another round. And Jim, more than a little bit drunk, wanders up to the performers' area with the best intentions new boyfriends always have about this kind of thing.
"Hi," he says, and prides himself on his cultural knowledge that he doesn't hold out his hand. "Great show tonight."
Sarissa looks him up and down before raising an eyebrow. "Thank you." Jim bounces on his heels.
"So I'm sure you get this a lot."
"Where do you wish me to sign?" Sarissa says smoothly.
"Oh, well, it's not for me. I'm a bit young. My brother, though, huge fan. But actually, my boyfriend, you were his favorite. He's just coming over now."
"Jim," Spock says, appearing at his elbow, "what are you doing?"
Spock, what a surprise. This is...
Devere, Sarissa says flirtatiously, and to Jim's surprise holds his hand out for a human-style handshake.
My stage name is Sarissa, but my given name is Devere, and I insist that friends use that.
Spock, Spock says, taking his hand and shaking it. He looks at Jim, slight panic written over his face.
Devere's pleasant demeanor drops. You are the one I heard yesterday. How charming.
He does not sound charmed.
Sir, Spock says.
Devere drops into another language. Jim had left his communicator in the room, and whatever language it is, his subdermal doesn't pick up at all. Spock looks like he has been slapped. He walks away from Devere, and Jim follows him, sitting down with their drinks.
What did he say? Jim asks. But Spock just stares at his drink for a long minute.
What is the aphorism? Never meet your heroes? He tries again. But Spock carries on, not saying anything, his brow furrowed in perplexed thought.
You're scaring me, Jim says eventually. Spock, please.
Spock snaps out of his reverie.
My apologies, Jim, he says, placing a hand on Jim's knee.
What just happened there? Jim says. And Spock shakes his head.
I am unsure. I must think.
Do you want to go back to the room?
No,
but I would be open to going for a walk. They finish their drinks and let a Bolian couple have their table weaving through the crowd until they're back on the main promenade.
Are you going to tell me what he said? Jim says a few minutes later as they stare out to sea.
He heard us.
Heard me. When we were in the throes of intercourse, Spock says.
I was vaguely aware at the end that there were telepaths nearby, but I did not stop myself.
Jim narrows his eyes.
This is a pleasure planet. It is logical that the, I don't know, psychic airwaves are full of people coming their brains out. Don't let him shame you. It's 2260, for fuck's sake, and I mean that literally.
That was not what he was saying, Spock says.
Or more, he was saying that in an attempt to shame me, but this behavior is curious in a Vulcan of his age and profession, and as you indicate, the setting. It is logical, therefore, his behavior is illogical. I believe he was, quote, on the offensive in order to deflect from something. I am also confused as to why he was scanning my mind by asking for a handshake, his overfamiliarity, even though I had not met him before.
All round, this has been a confusing interaction.
That is strange, Jim says.
Want to fuck about it?
Spock shoots him a look that is all heat.
I would. Let us return to the room.
They wake up the next morning together in the bright light of a perfect morning by the breeze blowing off the sea.
What shall we do today? Jim says, running his fingers down Spock's spine.
The night before had been incendiary, and he's feeling gloriously sore, but he's got some ideas about what they can do without getting out of bed to get the dermal or a hypo.
I would like to follow Devere, Spock says, climbing out of bed.
I have been thinking about his behavior last night, and I believe that there might be something going on.
Okay, Jim says, throwing the sheets off, exposing himself in the hope that Spock will succumb to temptation.
In his defense, Spock does look conflicted as he pulls another pair of those very handsome wide-legged trousers on, followed by a draped shirt that exposes an appetizing amount of chest hair.
Jim sighs and goes to shower.
Okay, but we're getting breakfast first, okay?
That is acceptable, Spock nods, but please shower quickly and bring your communicator.
The romance is dead, Jim mutters, closing the door.
Jim drags out breakfast as long as he can, which isn't hard, as the buffet is over 100 meters long and includes food options from all over the Federation.
If I'm ever given command, I'm having this installed. We'll rip out everything up to and including the warp core to make it possible, he says, groaning around a mouthful of freshly grilled Tellurian drop cakes.
Leonard won't even complain. He's always getting on me to eat more at breakfast. The man will not stop until I have my own gravimetric field.
Spock, as a sop to being on holiday, is enjoying another cup of tea, but is looking impatient while he does so.
I met Dr. McCoy at Captain Pike's New Year's party, he says. It was an enlightening experience.
Oh, God, Jim says, swallowing hastily. I completely forgot about that. What did he say?
I cannot betray the doctor's confidence that way, Spock says, taking a sip of tea before his eyes spot the thing he'd been looking for the whole time Jim had been getting his money's worth. Have you consumed enough for us to begin our mission?
Jim looks longingly at the bar before rolling his eyes. I'm ready as I'll ever be, he says begrudgingly, wiping his mouth with a napkin and getting up.
Good. We may not be able to stop for lunch, Spock says, walking away quickly, ignoring Jim's protestations.
Devere looks different in the light of day, without his stage makeup and stage fripperies. His pale hair highlights his Vulcan features, but also allows him to blend in with the otherwise mostly blonde Ryzen population. His skin is darker and greener than Spock's, with almost an olive-like tan, and he's wearing human-styled clothes, utilitarian pants, and a wraparound shirt, both in dark khaki. He is appearing to do his morning chores, stopping off at various shops along the back street of the Ryzen capital. The main street runs parallel to the pleasure promenade, with its gardens and beachfront views, but is decidedly more utilitarian. This road is open to skimmers and to the buses that crawl up and down the strip, and there are low warehouses and stores that advertise their reasonable wholesale rates and the availability of employment for anyone wishing to make their stay more permanent. They manage to follow along at a distance until they reach the residential area, at which point Devere steps into a block of apartments and disappears.
I do not think we can follow him, Jim says, and Spock agrees. But also, I don't think he's done anything wrong. He's bought some groceries, paid a bill, and picked up a pair of shoes from a cobbler. None of this is criminal behavior.
Spock leans against the wall of the house opposite and sighs. I understand. I hope you can continue to humor my following of this hunch. I have been trying to be more in tune with my instincts as an officer.
Jim leans against the same wall. It's fine, really. It's important to see the real places anyway, not just the polished areas for the tourists. Worse comes to worse. We know where to get the discount Orion booze Erica asked us to bring back now, and we've wasted a couple of hours. The beach isn't going anywhere.
Spock shudders at the memory.
Indeed. Last time I followed my instincts, I stole the Enterprise and stopped a war. Even if this is unsuccessful, this is still, as you would put it, a good average.
Wait, you stole the Enterprise? Jim asks.
But then Spock pulls him down because Devere has reappeared alongside a couple of large men and is walking with intent towards a nearby warehouse.
This could still be an errand, Jim says, as they creep along behind Devere and hide along the back wall of the industrial park they've ended up in.
Indeed, Spock says, pulling out his tricorder.
You brought your tricorder on vacation? Jim says. I'm hurt.
It is not personal, Spock says. But there is a strange reading coming from this warehouse, and there are 10 men inside. I suspect all are Vulcan. He looks up. Give me a boost, and I can look through that window.
Jim does, glad for the extra hours in the gym because Spock remains incredibly heavy.
Spock listens at the window for a minute and then gestures to be put down.
Fascinating, he says. They are discussing the upcoming Federation elections.
Who isn't, Jim says, frustrated himself.
The sooner we get rid of Rigel, the better. The guy is a liability.
That is not what they are discussing, though I do agree with your assessment of the president, Spock says. They are talking about vulnerabilities in the security framework.
Vulcans? Jim says incredulously.
I do not believe that man is Vulcan, Spock replies quietly, and then gestures for Jim to duck down as Devere leaves again, this time with a long, slim box slung under one arm. He bids goodbye to his companions with the Ta'al and heads back towards the town.
Do you think he's been altered? Jim asks.
He looks Vulcan to me, the ears, eyebrows, prissiness. He tilts his head appreciatively.
The appealing handsomeness.
Spock does not rise to the bait. I do not know. There is something off about him.
He's a very strange Vulcan either way, Jim says. Perhaps he's one of those logic rejectors.
I do not think so, Spock says. I am familiar with their methods.
And then he starts walking again, and Jim has to hustle to catch up.
They are not averse to the Federation, Spock explains. In fact, they are highly in favor of it. This is secessionist behavior, not fitting of a Vulcan.
Vulksit, you say, Jim says. Let us not go that far, Spock chastises.
Devere is walking now, clutching his new package to his chest. He ducks down one of the alleyways, and Jim and Spock watch as his posture changes from a loush, relaxed walk of a professional dancer to the deliberate stride of a military man as he strips the packaging off the package to reveal a pulse rifle.
Okay, Jim breathes and moves to follow, but Spock stops him with a hand to the middle of his chest.
Did you bring your communicator? He asks, and Jim pulls it out and hands it over.
We should let the planetary security know, he says.
I agree, Spock replies, once we have determined that they are not part of it.
Looking around, he grabs a pair of oars from a nearby kayak and hands one to Jim.
Follow me, he says.
Hang on, Jim stops him. I agree with you, but, he points at Spock, science officer, and then points at himself, security officer, you follow me.
The nice thing about Spock is that if you make a logical argument, he not only agrees, but it obviously does something for him. Jim is an expert at noticing the slight changes that indicate that Spock is hella turned on, and smiles to himself as he takes point, and is very sure that Spock has his eyes glued on his six. The back streets fall away quickly into dirt paths through the dense rainforest. There is no sign that Devere has gone anywhere but straight ahead, and so they take it as smoothly and quietly as they can, but it seems that wherever he was going, he wasn't expecting to be followed. The forest starts to thin out after about a kilometer, and Jim directs Spock into the trees so that they can approach away from the path. The clearing is large, and there are two small ships parked, neither of which Jim recognizes immediately. Devere is talking to another Vulcan-looking male, while three large and burly humanoids of unknown species unload crates of cargo from the right side ship.
Smuggling and treason, Jim murmurs, knowing that Spock can hear him, and then it hits him. He probably can't. It was never Vulcan hearing, it was the bond, and they don't have that anymore. They've been fucking with every bodily fluid, but Spock has been keeping his hands away from Jim's face as much as possible, touching only the dead parts of him, his hair, thick skin, clothing. He jerks out of this line of thinking because Spock is giving him a signal, and so he follows where he is pointing. Devere has opened his communicator and stepped away to make a call, heading towards Jim's hiding space. Spock sneaks out over into the clearing behind him, heading for the mooks unloading and unloading the merchandise, and Jim watches how he takes them down like a big cat, claws dug into the shoulder, and they go down like a sack of potatoes. There's a guard over here, but Jim can take one guy, so he heads out to intercept Devere. He tries to eavesdrop on the conversation, but even the communicator is struggling with it, meaning he's probably speaking in some sort of code, so he switches to record mode instead. He's stealthy and more than capable, so he incapacitates the guard with the butt of his oar and liberates his phaser and thumbs it to stun. It's not a model he recognizes, but it is probably something mass-market stylish by the angles. He's been in deep space too long to be up on the latest models coming out. Devere hears something and whips his head around and spots Spock taking down his accomplices, which forces Jim's hand. He pops up from behind a pile of boxes and aims for Devere's chest, but he's fast on those dancer's legs, and he's diving clear and pulling out his own phaser before Jim can get a shot off. The box near him explodes into splinters, and another falls over, spilling its contents, which in turn spilled their contents, over the dun ground, and the distinctive smell and bright color of the bottles immediately tells Jim what's at stake.
Devere grimaces at the sight of blue liquid fizzing on dirty ground, and that gives Jim enough of an opening to dive for him, knocking his phaser out of his hand and training both on him as he lies on the floor. "Nice to see you again," Jim says, and flips open his communicator to contact planetary security through the Starfleet emergency channel. It chirps acceptance immediately, and he snaps the communicator closed again. "You've got nothing on me," Devere mocks. "Just some friends, having a meeting and a clearing." "This is Romulan ale," Jim says. "It's highly illegal." "Just because you humans cannot handle your neurotoxins," Devere says dismissively. "We also cannot hold our acts of war either," Jim says. "Smuggling of contraband is a violation of the neutral zone." "The neutral zone is full of holes," Devere says. "Some things fall through. This is a pleasure planet. You should know that. There are all kinds of pleasures available should you know where to look." "I brought all the pleasure I wanted with me, thank you," Jim says. "Ah, yes. The son of Sarek with the loud mind. I assume he is nearby." "You could say that," Jim says, watching as Spock nerve pinches another mook in the background. "I've not met the parents yet. Any advice?" Devere smirks. "You'll have to get through the fiancé first," he says. And when Jim frowns in confusion, he takes that as an opportunity to lunge for him and promptly slumps to the ground when Spock throws his oar across the clearing and it hits him square in the back of the head. "I think we might be able to get lunch after all," Jim calls out across the clearing as planetary security beams in and starts to arrest people. Unfortunately, by the time planetary security releases them, it is long past lunch and almost past dinner. Jim and Spock stagger into the nearest restaurant to the security station and order huge plates of fish and rice and quietly devour them in silence before retiring to their room. "I saved this," Spock says, and produces a bottle of Romulan ale from the depths of his jacket. He cracks the seal in a way that, well, maybe Jim is just conditioned at this point, but is very, very hot. He raises the bottle and downs half of it, his glorious throat bobbing obscenely in the half-light. Jim steps into his personal space, takes the bottle from his hands and downs it, holding Spock's gaze almost the whole way down, until he is forced to close his eyes as the burn spreads through his throat and stomach. He drops the bottle, his chest heaving, and then Spock is picking him up and they're kissing, their mouths unfamiliar with the illicit burn of illegal alcohol, and Jim wraps his legs around Spock's waist and digs his hands into his hair and bites him, and beneath him Spock digs his hands in and falls onto the bed. Jim rolls them once they land, so Spock is underneath him and holds his hands down by the wrists. They wrestle like that for control, rolling around until they thump onto the floor, Jim face down, and Spock has him right there, screwing each of those glorious ridges into him just like the fantasy that never gets old. Usually their brutal fucks burn out quickly, but the Romulan ale does something all right, so once they run out of that energy, it changes, softens, and then Spock pulls him up to rest against his thighs and fucks him softly, gently, holding him up with one big hand, the other cradling his stick and balls so gently, not jacking him, just letting him grind into his hard cock and soft hands in each turn, kissing his neck, his throat, whispering and whimpering into his ear in his deep, dark voice, just how good Jim feels, how deep inside him he is, and how he never wants to let go. "What a day," Jim says, sprawled on the unmade bed, running a dermal over the carpet burn on his left cheek. "Not every day you bust a smuggling ring and get fucked that good. It's usually one or the other." Spock drops down onto the bed and kisses him deep and full. "I apologize for wasting the day. Tomorrow is our last full day on Ryza. Is there anything you wish to do?" "I only have two things left I want to do," Jim says. "One is to get flung out of that catapult thing. And the other is to take you out for a truly decadent dinner where we get dressed up, then undress you and fuck you over the balcony where everyone can see us, make my public claim on the infamous son of Sarek." Spock's breath catches in his chest. That is. I am amenable to this, yes, and dives in for another kiss. The hangover the next day is one of the worst things that has ever happened to Jim, and that is saying something. There is a reason this shit is illegal, he says, throwing the bottle into the recycler with a grimace. Spock is groaning on the balcony when Jim goes to find him. He's dressed in a green robe and nothing else, looking like he's lost all will to move or perhaps live. The robe leaves very little to the imagination, and Jim lets his brain absorb all of the lovely black hair that dusts Spock's thighs and his chest, his arms, and the dark shading to his face after just 2 days of not shaving. His skin has darkened in the sun. Even with the UV filters, he is developing a glorious tan, like he's been carved from olive wood. Jim feels rotten, and then remembers where he is and how many favors and credits he has spent in acquiring this room, and so calls down to the concierge for a hangover hypo. Two are brought up within 5 minutes, and once he's had a 20-minute nap and a shower, he feels back to normal. He changes into his swimmers and goes to nudge Spock awake. Hey, sleepyhead, do you want a hangover hypo? Jim, Spock says blearily, were we poisoned? Nope, that's just karma, Jim says, and gently presses the hypo against Spock's fluttering pulse. Give that half an hour, have a shower, and then shall we go get flung out of something similar to siege equipment? Spock groans but nods. And Jim thinks about going down to breakfast, but instead just lies down next to him and has a nap in the sun. Their final day is basically perfect. The catapult turns out to be only one of three separate insane machines intended to throw adrenaline junkies into deeper and deeper water, and both Jim and Spock absolutely throw themselves into all three with abandon, sailing through the air, being shot out of a torpedo tube, and finally taking part in a truly unhinged obstacle course that they had to sign a legal waiver to take part in. Spock manages to finish the course with all but three of the tokens, but Jim is emergency beamed out twice, first time right before he's impaled by a fish that flies out of a wall, and then again by a giant wooden cherry that somehow flies up rather than down. They grab lunch from the hotel restaurant and bring it back up to their room while Jim runs the tub. It's an enormous one, and there are so many bath accoutrements given alongside it that he wants to put all of them in and see what happens. Hopefully something good. So, I made reservations at Alcathane, Jim calls out to Spock in the other room. There's no immediate reply. Instead, Spock comes in frowning. That is a Vulcan restaurant, he says. A highly formal place. I know, Jim says, waggling his eyebrows. I brought my best suit. What time is the reservation? Spock asks. 8 p.m., Jim says, and Spock immediately stands up. I must make preparations. My apologies, Jim. I will meet you there, he says, leaning in for a quick kiss before darting out. Jim watches as Spock grabs a garment bag from the wardrobe and leaves the room. He checks the chrono. It is only just past 1600. Huh, he says, shaking his head, and gets into the bath. No point letting it go to waste. 4 hours later, Spock arrives just as Jim does. He is wearing formal robes that make Jim want to tear them off him. He looks incredible, regal, like a prince. He's wearing makeup, and it makes Jim's mouth go dry. His usually compelling eyes look hypnotic, framed with deep royal blue. His eyelashes smudged with black and his skin is flawless. His lips stained green in the center like a bruise, like he's already been ravaged by a lover. Holy fuck, Jim says. All concerns about making Spock bolt abandoned. You look incredible. Spock bows. This is the minimum required for a place such as this, as you will see. Should I change? Jim asks, suddenly nervous. He's wearing a tie, but his suit is just plain navy, and the shirt is just a normal white one. Spock shakes his head. No, you look appropriate, he says, and kisses him. Let us get our table. Spock is right.
Upon giving their reservation, they are led into a private elevator and whisked up into the restaurant high above the tree line. The views are spectacular, and they take their seats at a table that is inlaid with gemstones and calligraphy. There is no menu. Jim is prepared for this. The restaurant serves a traditional Vulcan menu that is made up of 15 courses to represent Sirach's 15 verses, each paired with a different wine. It is extravagant and beautiful and eye-wateringly expensive and difficult to get into. He'd been lucky to get a cancellation, and he'd even taken a preemptive antihistamine hypo in case of any undisclosed ingredient mishaps. The waiter brings the first course with a flourish, a delicate wafer that bursts on the tongue, paired with a spring wine so fresh and cold it almost tastes of nothing at all, until it warms up in the mouth like the coming of summer, hot skin and fresh berries and long nights in a single mouthful. Oh, wow, he breathes. And even Spock looks pleased. The meal is a triumph of Vulcan-Risian hybrid cuisine, the waiter explains, focusing on the fish and sea resources of the archipelago, combined with the traditional flavors and techniques of the Ra'al region of Vulcan. It is absolutely delicious, and the evening echoes this. They talk of everything and of nothing, flirting like he wishes he had done at the start. Spock has a beautiful mind, is an engaging conversationalist, and the hours fly past. They eat the final course with a lingering sigh of genuine sorrow, and Jim closes his eyes, treasuring the moment of being there above the trees in paradise. Jim, I do not know if you know the protocol, but if you are going to do it, you should do it now, Spock says quietly. But they are interrupted at that point by the manager. Do sirs require anything else? She asks. We will be closing promptly. Give us a minute, Jim says, twirling his napkin nervously in his fingers. And when she leaves, he leans forward. What are you talking about? He whispers. The proposal, Spock says. Jim barks out a laugh and then realizes that Spock is 100% serious. What? We just broke the bond. This is our first vacation. Spock looks like he has been slapped. I see. My apologies for reading the situation wrong. Jim reaches out and takes his hand before he can snatch it back. It's not a no, okay? It's a not now. Same as before. I'm sorry for being insensitive. I understand, Spock says, swallowing against nothing. Jim, please understand. This is difficult for me. I do not know the timelines of human relationships. Please do not worry. Jim sighs, running his hands through his hair. Look, I'm not good at relationships, as you may have heard through the grapevine. I've left a lot of broken hearts across the fleet and outside of it, but I love you. No qualifiers or modifiers. I am in love with you. These last few days have been heaven to me, and I want to build something with you. But the word there is build. I need time. I cannot rush this, or I'll just regress to being the guy who loves too fast and leaves too soon. Spock nods. I understand. Let us forget this. We shall, as they say, laugh about this in the future. Jim laughs, but it's forced and tinged with panic. I'll get the bill, then let's go and get drunk somewhere that serves burgers, okay? We still haven't gone dancing, and I don't know about you, but I think we have some energy to burn. They walk back to the main strip and enter the first club with decent music. Jim orders them shots, and they down them before heading to the dance floor. The place is hot, steamy, and Spock's makeup is dripping off his face with the humidity. As they grind together to the pulsing, relentless beat, Jim's face buried in Spock's neck, Jim feels like shit. Like the bottom has fallen out of the perfect weekend, revealing the cracks in himself he was so careful to paper over, still there, as dangerous as before. Kirk to Farragut, Kirk says the next morning after checking out.
They slept together, pressed close, but it felt like a chasm had opened up, and he couldn't seem to find the words to breach it. Two to beam up. And they whirl away from paradise in a beam of light as if they'd never been there. They materialize on the transporter pad, and Captain Reuben is there waiting for them. "Welcome back, Jim. I hope you're well rested," he says, but doesn't wait for an answer before turning to Spock. "Lieutenant, good to see you again. Glad to have you for the week. My chief science officer is ecstatic that you're coming to whip us into shape." "I am pleased to see the research you have been doing," Spock says politely. "And you boys even managed to bring us a present back from paradise," Reuben says, turning to Jim with his eyebrows raised and hands clasping together. "Pardon, sir?" Jim asks. "We're transporting the prisoner you apprehended back to the starbase," Reuben says. "The whole crew are fizzing. Had I known that we had this many LLAP fans on board, I would have made different decisions vis-a-vis not flying the ship into that star last week. You're going to have to put the oldest and most pretentious security on brig duty, or there's going to be a mutiny." "Understood, sir," Jim says. "Can't stand it myself." "I seem to remember you knew all the words when we saw him perform," Spock says blandly, and Jim shoots him an evil look, and Reuben laughs bodily. "Spock, I'm going to like you. Come, let me show you to your rooms. You're in guest quarters on deck 8. "Sir," Jim says, and Reuben holds a hand up. "Not without an engagement ring," Reuben says jovially, and Jim just smiles at him, tight-mouthed. "Right you are, sir. Spock, I'll see you later," he says, and exits out the other door so he doesn't have to see Spock's face. A week. A week to fix this. He can do this. It isn't all broken yet. It can be saved. He reaches his quarters and slumps down onto his bed and tries to pull himself together before getting up and putting his dirty clothes into the laundry bags for processing, trying to keep buoyant, making plans, and trying to calm his racing heart. He's about to go and tackle his inbox, preparing for beta shift later that afternoon, but that is the moment his communicator lights up with a call from Carol. The end.